Number 20 was put in there because we were in the height of the space race when that hymnal was written, and several members on the committee were from Houston, Texas. And that was a political move to make nice to those guys who were in the aerospace industry. It's a horrible song. I just like to give Zach a hard time. Yeah, surprise, spoiler alert, yeah. Okay, it's great to be able to come to church and laugh. You know, not only do we have a faith that sings, which is, I think, unparalleled in the world. I'm not sure that any of the other living religions have hymnology, anything close to what we do anyway. But it's also a faith that allows us to be merry, to have joy and laughter. And so it's great. It's great to have a Savior who gave his life that we might be made right with God. So many of the ones you were picking tonight were just so perfect for this season of the year, this Holy Week that we find ourselves in the midst of. Tonight we're going to the front half of the gospel. So we're back in Matthew chapter 5. We're examining the core teachings of Jesus. And again, the Sermon on the Mount, although I have no doubt that he taught this as Matthew records it, these are the repeated themes that Jesus continued to go back to throughout the 3 years that he taught. This wasn't a one-off and then he moved to a different sermon series where he addressed different topics. This was at the heart of what he wanted people to understand. And I honestly believe that if I could only have three chapters of the Bible, I'd take these three because they are so practical and there is so much. Now, people ask me all the time, what's the best translation? I'm buying a new Bible. What translation should I get? And I will ask a few questions and try to help them navigate that. The bottom line is the Greek language is not difficult to translate into English. It's impossible. I tell people translating Greek into English is like trying to stuff an elephant into a shot glass. You just can't get there from here. And Hebrew, although it doesn't have nearly the vocabulary of Greek, is equally challenging moving to English because of its limited vocabulary. Hebraic words have many meanings, whereas Greek has many, many words to express a pretty fine-tuned concept. Hebrew has, you can take a lot of those words a lot of different ways, and if we don't have multiple uses of those words in the Old Testament, some of those Hebrew words in the Old Testament show up one time. And it's very difficult to strike a bead because it is driven by emotion, it's poetical, and they don't look at things the way we as descendants of European and Greek thought look at things. It's a very different worldview that makes it, I think, unnatural for us to get Hebrew translations right. And so, at any rate, that brings us tonight to Matthew chapter 5. We're just grinding our way through the Beatitudes because in these simple little verses, there is huge background. And tonight we come to Matthew chapter 5, verse 5, where my translation says, God blesses those who are humble, and they will inherit the earth. Many of your translations will say, blessed are the meek. Those are both legitimate translations of the Greek word here. The Greek word that is used in Matthew 5, 5 is the Greek word praios, praiotes. In different forms, it depends on the context and all these crazy things that make Greek so incredibly complex. This word only occurs four times in the New Testament. And generally, it is translated most of the time it's translated as gentle or gentleness. And in this case, it is often translated meekness. And when we think of that concept, gentleness or meekness, what comes to mind? You talk about a man who is meek. Milquetoast, doormat, spineless, easily manipulated or intimidated. Meekness in our culture has taken on a very, very negative image. I think of Don Knotts in like The Ghost and Mr. Chicken, you know, where he gets up in front of a group and he's petrified and he just talks in circles and you would look at it, that's a meek man right there, you know. He and most of his characters were that way. Let me explain about that. And we see this as, we read it in Scripture and we filter that against our cultural bends and we see this is not a good thing. I don't think I want to be that. Again, we are missing so much of what this Greek word, simple Greek word, is trying to convey. John MacArthur, in his commentary on this passage, says that praios, which basically means mild or soft, the term sometimes was used to describe a soothing medicine or a soft breeze. If you've ever hauled hay and you get a praus breeze, you are thankful for that. Thankful for that. That soft, that comforting, that soothing breeze that comes and gives you a little respite from the work and the weight. It's refreshing. It reminds me, there are several things. It reminds me of that church in Revelation of Laodicea, where God says, I wish that you were either hot or cold, but because you are neither hot nor cold, I will vomit you out of my mouth. That we tend to misunderstand that passage, and without going into a completely different sermon, we tend to think of hot is good there and cold is bad. And God's either saying, I wish you were just on fire for me, or that you were just absolutely cold in your faith and just sitting and doing nothing, but because you're just lukewarm, just because you're middle of the road, I'm going to vomit you up. And it's not at all what he's telling John. Laodicea was in between Hierapolis and Colossae. The mountains above Colossae are like the Rockies. They're snow-covered. And that snow melts in the spring, and cascading down those mountains is this fresh, bracing, cold, clear water that is just refreshing. Over at Hierapolis to the northwest, to the northwest of Laodicea is Hierapolis, where there are volcanic hot springs. And they are boiling hot, and they are laden with minerals. And the geology of that area where those things have deposited those minerals over the ages, the water is this strange color blue, because the white of the calcification of the pools where it is, and creates this ribbon work of mineral that these things are on. People came from all over the world to go and to soak in the hot springs of Hierapolis. And it was therapeutic, and it would relieve arthritis and bursitis. Max, if we were there, we'd grab one of those bad boys, and we would soak till they made us get out of the pool. You know, and Jesus is saying, hot's good, and cold is invigorating and refreshing, stimulating. He said, whatever God's created you be that. But those two streams of water came together at Laodicea. and you got that fresh, clean, pristine water from the snow melt mixing with the hot water that's mineral laden, and you got this tepid mineral water. And literally people would come to the well there, the pool at Hierapolis, after traveling, and take a drink and literally vomit. It was so disgusting. And we're to be what God's created to be: soothing, meek, gentle, refreshing. Or we're to be warm and therapeutic and healing. But don't be in the middle. Don't be that useless thing that you can't even choke down. It pulls up images to me of that passage. There are several places here that this takes me to a different spot. This is a good thing. It's that soothing medicine or that soft breeze. It was used of colts and other animals that were domesticated, whose natural spirits were broken by a trainer so that they could do useful work. I think, Jackie, of the pictures of you guys riding the elephants in Thailand, that a little bitty human being can teach a great big elephant to do anything. It's kind of crazy. They don't have to mind us. You know, they squash us like a bug. But we can domesticate them. Used to be able to go to SeaWorld and see Shamu, the killer whale, you know, this big, huge thing, and these people are riding around on his nose, and he's just pushing them through the water. Train an orca to do tricks? Amazing. That's what James says. We've trained all manner of animals, tamed all manner of animals. We can't control the slab of meat that's in our mouth, but this idea of a domesticated animal, a horse. You ever been stepped on by a horse? Kicked by a horse? You know, those things are bigger, faster, stronger than we are. But we can put a little shank of steel in their mouth and turn them anywhere we want them to go. And that is another level of this word. That we can train these animals, control them. As a human attitude, it's meant to be gentle of spirit, meek, submissive, quiet, tender-hearted. During his triumphal entry into Jerusalem that we were talking about this morning, Jesus was hailed as the coming king, though he was gentle and mounted on a donkey. Paul lovingly referred to the meekness and the gentleness of Christ as the pattern of his own attitude. This is what we've been called to be. He goes on to say that the essential difference between being poor in spirit and being meek or gentle may be that poverty in spirit focuses on our sinfulness, whereas meekness focuses on God's holiness. It's an interesting point of clarification, trying to get this word. It's a little tiny word, just five letters in the Greek, basically, and yet it speaks volumes. So as we look at this word, basically there are three shades of meaning here, three different ways to view it, at least. In my limited work on this verse, this is what I found. And first is that meekness was, according to Aristotle, who was a Greek speaker, you know, by birth, he says that praeotes is the center point between extremes, between a glutton and an anorexic. He didn't say that, but I'm just giving you something that I can relate to. In French, they have gourmets, and gourmets appreciate subtle textures and subtle flavors and the, you know, all of these fine nuances of food. You can go pay $100 for a plate that mostly has sauce on it, you know, so they make it look bigger than the food really is. And there are people who just love that. Those of you who are real foodies, and you take, you know, great joy in just that that exquisite bite. And then there are people like me that are gourmands, and we just like food. You know, I just like to eat. I don't care if it's Cheetos or what, you know. It doesn't have to be exotic for me. I can appreciate exotic foods and things like that, but I just like to eat. And as long as it doesn't set my face on fire, you know, I'm pretty good with it. And so, but he's saying that somewhere between that gourmand, that glutton that just will eat anything and eats all the time, to the one who doesn't want to eat at all, somewhere in there is meekness in between. He says the difference between a spendthrift person and a miser. And Aristotle says the middle point between that is a generous person. A person who is generous. They understand wealth, but they're not hoarding it. They're frugal, but they're giving. And we're looking for that mean point, that center between the extremes. One who is always angry and one who is never angry. It's interesting, in marital counseling you'll find this. And I'll have wives who will tell me, I just wish he'd get mad once in a while. I never know what he's thinking. He never talks to me. He's never passionate about anything. Just, you know, I don't care if he yells, just let me know that this is important. And you have those people who are so even temperamented that everything's, okay, whatever, okay. And you just have that. And so we're looking for that middle ground between always angry. And I think our culture borderlines on this right now with the COVID stuff. You look at social media and all the extremes. Nothing's in the middle. It's all out here on the edges. And there's this undertone, this undercurrent in our culture right now that it's just dry tinder waiting for a match to drop. And it's going to go up like a haystack, because there's just this undercurrent of being frustrated and angry and powerless, and we have that going on. And so there's just this we're just ripe to flash into anger. This is not what Aristotle's talking about. He's talking about that person who's always angry at the right time, about the right things, and never angry at the wrong time about the wrong things. I don't know how you work. I don't know how your mind works. But I think probably more often than not, I get mad for stupid reasons. I get mad when I don't get my way. I get mad over things I have no control of. You know, it didn't start here. I didn't vote for it. You know, it's not anything that I have anything to do, and it makes me angry. And I get angry and I stay angry, and you know, and I'm angry over things I have no power to change. Folks, that's just a wasted anger. It's just wasted emotion to be angry about things that we have no ability to fix. And we're just wasting it. And yet at the same time, we're not angry over things that we have the ability to fix, and it doesn't make us angry. Jesus comes in that triumphal entry that we talked about this morning, comes into Jerusalem riding the donkey, the crowd singing his praises. And what does he do when he gets into Jerusalem? What's he do? He does one thing and one thing only, according to Scripture. Anybody? He goes to the temple and he looks around, and they go back. They leave town. He does one thing. He comes back in on Monday morning or Tuesday morning, and what's the first thing he does? Cleanses the temple. Drives out the sacrifice sellers and the money changers. Now, I did this mental image of Jesus that evening with some leather, and he's braiding a whip. And the disciples are going, why is Jesus making a whip? He's seen that chaotic nightmare. 250,000 sheep, or the remnant of whatever that herd was, flock was, by the time he got there. And it made him angry. Because his house wasn't to be a house of sacrifice sellers and money changers. His house was to be a house of prayer for all nations, the ta ethne. If we had been in Jerusalem on that day, we would have been kneeling to pray in the midst of all of those sheep, all of the urine, all of the feces, all of the chaos, all of the haggling, all of the mommy, mommy, I want that one. Daddy, daddy, get me that one. All of that going on in the closest place we could get to where the presence of God manifests itself. And it made him mad. Don't tell me when he was turning over those tables, he wasn't angry. But he wasn't angry for himself. He was angry for the helpless people who were being forced into that environment, into that place, that time, where their ability to commune with God was trampled by 250,000 sheep. Angry at the right time, never angry at the wrong time. Angry for the right reasons, never angry for the wrong reasons. The second level that MacArthur alludes to is referring to the domesticated animal. Power under control. Every instinct, every impulse, every passion of a human being. I know horses get mad. I've been on a mad horse, not foaming at the mouth mad, but angry mad. And you can tell when a horse is having a bad day. And they'll mind, but they don't mind nice. I was riding this horse one time for some friends, and his name? Stormy. His name was Stormy. He was born, the night he was born, a tornado blew the end of his barn out. And Stormy, he was a few fries short of a happy meal, but he was an angry animal. And I was on the back of Stormy, and he decided he was going to grab a mouth of clover, and I didn't have any problem with it. We were just getting him out of the barn, stretching his legs. So if he wanted to chew on a little clover along the way, he's carrying me along. He deserved it. And he did that two or three times. And about the third or fourth time he went down for clover, he decided he was going for a roll. And I mean, this old fat boy got out of those stirrups real fast and slid off either side. I didn't care which. It was just not going to be the downhill horse side with him on top of me. And I moved like I've never moved before. But he's just being ornery. He was just having it. He didn't care to be me up there, and he didn't want to listen. And he was having a bad day. It got worse for him because his trainer was riding, we were riding with her, and she said, let me take him. You get on my little mare, and I got on her little mare. Felt like John Wayne, big man, little horse. And she gets on Stormy, and we take off to go again, and he decides he's going to grab a mouthful of clover, and she stood up in the stirrups and yanked back on the reins, and the horse was looking at her, and all you could see in his eyes was white. He didn't go after another bite of clover, man. She straightened him right out. But, he's having a bad day as an angry animal. He was mostly domesticated, but he was still yielding to his will and his passions, and we get that way. You look at people who are victims of their passions. Their passions rule them. We see political leaders all the time who can't keep their hands to themselves, and it gets them in trouble. And this meekness is that ability to keep those impulses, those natural instincts, those passions of our life under control. And in Jesus, we see the omnipotent power of God in Jesus Christ. He could do anything. He could turn stones into bread. He could walk on the water. He could bring the four-day-old dead back to life. His power was limitless, but it was completely under the Father's control. I've told you before, it's that image of that prototypic horse, the horse that every horse wants to be, standing on the hill, muscles ripped and rippling in the breeze and sweat glistening on its fur and the mane blowing, you know, back in the wind, and this incredible strong horse and a bit in its mouth. Power under control. And that is praotes. The third possibility here for this word I thought was interesting. It turns out that praotes is the opposite of hupsilocardia. Hupsilocardia, that's a wonderful Greek word. That means lofty-heartedness. Lofty-heartedness. Or having a quality of teachablelessness. Not being teachable. And folks, I can work with just about anybody, but I have a hard time working with people that aren't teachable. We need to learn from our mistakes, realize our own limitations. The great Roman orator by the name of Quintilian, he was a teacher of oratory, and he said of certain scholars, they would no doubt be excellent students if they were not already convinced of their own knowledge. I got this. I know that already. You can't tell me anything. You know, don't try to clue me in. I know it all. My dad he'd look at people like that and he'd say, if I could buy him for what he's worth and sell him for what he thinks he's worth, I could retire. That is this person. They are unteachable. They are so full of themselves and so overconfident in their own knowledge and education and training and experience that they are unteachable. Nobody can tell me anything. And that is the opposite of this praotes, gentle, meek spirit that Jesus is telling us that we are to embody. We realize our own limitations. It doesn't matter how many times I've read the Bible through, how many Bible classes I sat through, how long I've been in the ministry. It doesn't matter about any of those things. I need to be open and yielded and teachable so as His Word speaks to me, I can take it in and let it transform me, continue to transform me. Because if I'm still alive, number one, He's not finished with me. And number two, I don't look enough like Jesus yet. And so in order for that transition, that transformation to happen, I have to be meek, so that He can teach me. William Barclay handles these Beatitudes, I think, better than anybody I've ever read. And he says that when you put it all together, the handful of words, "Blessed are the meek, for they shall inherit the earth," becomes, "Oh, the bliss of the man who was always angry at the right time and never angry at the wrong time, who has every instinct, impulse, and passion under control because he himself is God-controlled, who has the humility to realize his own ignorance and his own weaknesses. For a man like that, for such a man, is a king among men." You see, Greek is just really big, and English is just really thin. And that sums up, I think, what this singular verse is trying to tell us. It is multi-level. It covers various places in our own character. But when we come to the place where we are not angry when we are hurt, but angry when the innocent and the powerless are. When we have our instincts and our impulse and our passions under the control of the Holy Spirit, and when we realize how puny and ignorant and weak we are, then God's got us in a place where we can impact our world. I used to believe there were two kinds of sin, the kind that I could handle and the kind I needed God to handle. And I could handle the big stuff. I wasn't likely to kill anybody. I grew up in a home where I had basically everything I needed. I didn't go steal things, and I didn't. You know, there were just things that I wasn't going to do. And then I needed help with a tongue that wasn't very well controlled. I needed help with thought life that didn't always focus on God the way I should. And there are just these two kinds of sins. And I went to a pastor's conference in the state of Oklahoma years ago, and I heard a man talking about when his ministry turned around. And he had the same story as me. Grew up in a Christian home, went to a Baptist college, went to seminary, got married, got his first church, and believed there were two kinds of sin. And he found out in a very real way that was not the case, that there was no sin that given the right circumstances he would not be willing to commit. And God broke him down. And he said that day, kneeling in the gravel and the glass on the shoulder of the road in the middle of Oklahoma City, God taught him meekness. And he said, that's when my ministry turned around. Folks, the world needs meek people.